Good evening and welcome to Screen Tone Club. This is your fortnightly look at manga, episode 68. We are recording on the 17th of January, 2021, and for release on Tuesday, the 19th of January, 2021. My name, as always, is Elliot Page, and I'm joined, as always, by my lovely co-host, Mr. Andy Hanley. How are you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well, as always. So, yeah, things are good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but it's been bloody cold here, and, you know, living in Scotland, but the snow has been nice. Also nice, I have lovely neighbours who shoveled the snow away from my front door for me, which honestly is like one of the smallest but nicest kindnesses people have done for me recently, especially due to the whole lockdown thing. So I don't know why, but I just thought that was a really nice thing someone did for me, even if it was, you know, kind of just a few feet of snow.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's useful stuff. Yeah, the snow has been kind of nice to have a bit of here, especially in these working from home times where you're not like, oh god, how do I get into work? Less nice has been the ice at times that has been just like pure kind of time to go ice skating everywhere around the area, in which case I've just stayed inside and watched other people sliding around in slightly comical fashion.
Yeah, I'm just on top of a small hill. It's only about like a 10-meter difference, but the gradient is kind of ridiculous, and I've left the house more than once thinking I should just take a tea tray with me to slide down on, you know, just give in and have a sled, you know.
Getting back up
the hill is a different problem.
Moving to Scotland gave me a whole new kind of like respect for when it's icy, because I feel like down south when it's icy it's like, okay, well, be a bit careful but you'll be fine. Like there was a time when I decided to walk into work on an icy day, I slipped at the top of a hill and basically like went down the entire thing on my backside, and like it was a quick way to travel, but you know, perhaps a little less graceful than I might have liked.
Yeah, unfortunately, replacing a tailbone isn't really something you can do, especially when you start getting on. So, God, this is old men yell at cloud manga podcast here. Sorry. If you'd like us to talk about more manga and less adventures in ice and snow, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Our lovely patrons help defer the cost of all the manga we buy, and also help give us ideas for what we should cover in our monthly bonus episodes, available only for patrons. So if you'd like to directly influence our lives and what we read, feel free to jump on the Patreon. Also on the Patreon is our shout-outs tier. And hello again to Mr. Rob Jessup, with great thanks once again for supporting us. And with that out of the way, we have our Returning Champions, which is our section where we look at series we've talked about previously on the podcast, but once again. We both have like a small docket of stuff we've been catching up on, but Andy, I'd like to like throw the baton at you first, actually, because I want to hear what you think about catching up with more of Don't Toy With Me, Miss Magatoro, which we talked about last episode. So please, I want to hear what you think about this continuing series.
Yeah, so yeah, like that was my pick for the last episode, and my feelings at the time was like I was really compelled to read more of it, but wasn't entirely sure. But you talked me around on it, Elliot, and well, that and the fact that it was still all super cheap on Comixology, so I ended up picking up volumes 2 through to 4. Then volume 5 came out and was still kind of cheap enough. So I'm basically completely caught up with the English releases now, and I've read through the entire thing. And I've enjoyed it all. Like it's been really good fun. It's kind of weird, like looking back on that first volume by the time you get to volume 5, because like Senpai's entire kind of place in that series has kind of changed. It changes quite markedly. Like he kind of just ends up just being kind of part of the gang that just like hangs out with these girls, like who are kind of Nagatoro's other friends. And while he still kind of gets teased and stuff, like it's on a completely different level to sort of those early chapters in particular. So it's kind of like a little bit wild to see that development go on. And it feels like the end of volume 5 is very much set up to do a bit more of the same and kind of move in some more different directions, which, you know, I think it's probably what it needs to do. It's kind of one of those things where it's like, this might be the point where I've had my fill, but I'm also still a little bit curious to see where it goes next. But yeah, like I've enjoyed it. I do feel like the artwork has kind of dropped off a bit post volume 3. It kind of feels like the author has maybe learned a lot about deadlines and is having to be like, okay, I need to rein this back a little bit. Because, I mean, you know, one of the things we talked about on the last show was the kind of absolute sort of slavish devotion to kind of giving Nagatoro the best possible expressions in almost every panel. And it feels like a lot of that drops off, and some of the general kind of level of detail drops off as well. Like, not to the point where I'm suddenly like, oh, it looks bad, and oh, why is Nagatoro a stick figure or anything, but it just isn't quite as sharp, I feel, as it is in the first few volumes, which was kind of notable. And also, volume two in particular kind of gets a bit horny. Like, it's sort of
it
hits some moments. Like, because again, like, that was something I mentioned on like volume one, where you can kind of feel the author kind of reining it in, and you kind of get that feeling of like what he wants to draw versus what is actually hitting the page. And it feels like that equation tilts a little bit more towards like what he wants to see here and there, like never to the point of being kind of like too over the top, but it's a very noticeable kind of like some of the restraints are off, which is kind of the opposite of what a lot of series does, where you kind of tend to get that stuff in volume one as a kind of cheap way to sell people in on series, and then it kind of knocks it off. Whereas this time around, it felt like it was a really conscious decision not to go down that route, and then kind of temptation crept in subsequent volumes to be like, I could just do a little bit of this, why not?
Yeah, it's volume two, as you say. I feel like it's one of these cases where like the limiters start bursting off of them as they're reaching their power, their increased power level, and it's like, oh, this is doing quite well, and you know, people seem to like it, and maybe I can get a bit more horny. And I think that's also the volume where the references to like the author's other works start creeping in, and then, as you say, it kind of, I feel like maybe the success of it or the reach of the series kind of encourages him to maybe sort of tamp it down just a smidge back to volume one or lower levels. Because you know, it is this sort of thing where you can kind of see the like the armor plating bursting off of the Evangelion, almost, to use a stupid reference. Thinking about it, not a lot of people probably get that reference now, given how old that series is. But yeah, you do get the feeling that, you know, it's starting to kind of burst out of itself. And yeah, also, like, as you say, the art seems to, I think, I wouldn't say it reduces in quality. I think it mostly just calms down after volume three, partially because, you know, it's done an awful lot of very individualistic, very unique stuff with not just Nagatoro, but the other characters. And it's now, especially like volume five, has started to reach a point of, you know, like shorthand, where they have a box of tricks and they can use them, and that kind of works as shorthand. It almost reminds me of, this is a comparison you never thought you'd hear, but it reminds me of Yotsuba, where if you compare like volume eight of that series versus volume one, the art style is like wildly different, because the individuality of the art has kind of like settled into this like known toolbox and palette of like shorthand, and also just character, like, you know, sort of like just shorthand ways of drawing the characters, like, you know, their sort of range, and they've been sort of like demarcated in terms of what their reactions and faces are. I mean, not just Nagatoro, but her friends as well. I mean, you have the rather like dense one and the rather aggressive grinning one, and they become a bit more sort of staked out almost in their terms of their like their range, as I say. So it settles into this kind of comfortable sort of like blanket of, oh, this lot. And as you say, like, Senpai starts to become more like one of the group, to the point where in volume five it actually introduces an antagonist who comes along to upset the status quo of the situation, which I'm very interested to see what happens with that, mostly because it's like, oh, this is a complete departure in terms of what the characters are doing. And it also puts basically everyone on the back foot, whereas, if anything, it feels like Senpai is one who's the least offset by everything that's going on. But yeah, I'm glad to hear you carried on with it and enjoyed it. And yeah, there's still quite a few volumes in Japan, so hopefully they'll continue with the current like pacing of releases. And yeah, as you say, it's not that expensive, mostly because Vertical seem to be like chucking it out there at a very reasonable base price, which then gets knocked down even further in sales. So yeah, it's not too painful to pick up and have a look at.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was definitely kind of the thing that absolutely tipped me over the edge. It's like, you know, not a huge cost of entry here. But yeah, like, I mean, the art quality thing, I think, like, had I probably not, like, read it at the crazy clip of, like, reading kind of five volumes in a week, I probably wouldn't have noticed it so much. Like, imagine if I'd have read every volume as it came out, it would have slipped under my radar a lot more than kind of when I literally went from volume 3 to volume 4 just like that, and then, you know, it becomes a far more obvious, like, oh, this feels a bit different. But yeah, it's enjoyable. And the other thing that I kind of found myself thinking, just to kind of close off, is, you know, again, having talked on the last podcast about sort of the origins of sort of Nagatoro's character and how that sort of came about, like, there's definitely still kind of a really important remnant of that idea that kind of sits in that series, because thanks to Senpai kind of being sort of like a nameless, not really quite a self-insert character, but kind of like sort of offset enough that you can almost sort of push that character aside. Like, there is quite a kind of personal sense of watching Nagatoro's character kind of not grow so much, but, like, you get to see them open up. And, like, there's a real kind of feeling of any kind of, like, normal sort of relationship, whether it's, like, romantic or friendship that you have with people, where when you first meet anybody, like, they'll always present their idealized version of themselves, and there'll always be a barrier up somewhere, like, with the vast majority of people. And then over time, you kind of see that get dropped, and kind of one of the enjoyable things is seeing those little kind of disarmed moments when you realize that somebody's not putting their guard up around you, and you get to see the real person underneath. And, like, this series is really good at having those little moments, and, like, sometimes they're kind of from Senpai's point of view, sometimes they're not, they're just kind of, like, shots where, you know, Nagatoro is looking away from him, but as the viewer you kind of get to see it, and, you know, you just get to see the little smiles and reactions and stuff, and a lot of that stuff, like, really helps to build that character and kind of, like, make them whole, in a sense, in a way that is kind of really pleasing, and that I don't think a lot of other series do in quite the way this one does.
Yeah, I feel like it happens, well, as you say, it happens most for Nagatoro because she is the principal and focus character. But I think it happens with the entire friend group where, you know, again, terrible metaphor alert, but it's like a jigsaw where, like, the pieces have slotted into place. And instead of everyone, as you say, having their shields up and being quite guarded and also, like, aggressively putting forward their particular personality they want to project, all of them kind of, like, relax into a more sort of, like, natural state around each other. I mean, that happens, like, generally. Really, I mean, it's like, you know, when you get to know people, you start to let your guard down and just kind of hang out. And that's really what's kind of happened with the group. And things only get tense when they start poking fun at each other a bit too much, or in particular, someone treads on Nagatoro's toes, which is half the joy of watching her react to stuff, especially in later chapters. So that's, yeah, as you say, it is nice to see that. I mean, it happens with all of them, but as you say, it happens the most with Nagatoro. Like, you know, even, and like, you know, it's kind of this translation, instead of her just, like, relentlessly bullying Senpai, like, you know, she offers to help him out, and, you know, she's a bit more forceful because that's her character. It's like when, you know, they go jogging in the morning and it's like, oh yeah, okay, fair enough. She does seem like the sort of person who would have this weird, like, you know, help you out type thing, even if she dresses it up in, like, you know, poking you in the ribs and laughing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And there is a part of me that kind of feels like now some of the edges have been knocked off of her character, like she kind of, like, ends up being a bit more of a traditional tsundere in places, which is kind of a bit less interesting. But overall, it's still an enjoyable kind of, like, movement in those characters and their kind of interrelationships to see. So yeah, it's been time well spent.
Yeah, if anything, I'm just kind of glad that we have a tsundere without someone pointing directly at her and going, look, isn't she a tsundere? Which most series tend to do now. In fact, one of the series in this episode we're going to talk about later does that, although that's on purpose. So, I don't know. I enjoy the return of the tsundere. It's still a good trope. I enjoy it. So, whatever. Come at me.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So, do you mind if I take one
no,
just for a second?
Go for it.
Cool. So, also, this is going to be a bit shorter, but also on the This Was Cheap, so I thought I would take a look at it, Ben, because it's on sale. I picked up Volume 2 of Rent-A-Girlfriend, which we talked about in a previous episode, and, you know, there has been an anime series. And the reason why it's going to be a very short return is that I could only read about 10 pages of it before I got extremely frustrated with the main cast and deleted it off my tablet. Because, man, fuck this series. I got every single thing that I hated about the characters from the first first volume, like, came roaring into view, like the manipulation of Mammy, the like ex-girlfriend character, the main character being a complete moron who like is actively destroying and sabotaging himself and making him out to be the worst version of himself, the art being extremely horny, and just all of it just made me like just scream. Not out loud, because that'd have scared the cat. But I thought, we'll see how it develops, you know, whatever. And within 10 pages, I was like, no, I'm done. Like, I can't. I cannot waste my time or my attention on this garbage. And so off it went. Kodansha got my money, but they won't get any more of it, I suppose, after this, because I refuse to go back to that series. So, there's my particular take on that series then. It's an extension of what we talked about previously, but perhaps in a more unforgiving format.
Yeah, I think it definitely makes me feel very glad that the anime adaptation exists, because it feels like, you know, from everything I've seen and heard, that adaptation like knocks a lot of the rough edges off and kind of like burns through the annoying part of that series to get to the good bit in a way that you simply can't with the manga, and there's just too much of that stuff to even hope to get through to get to anything vaguely interesting.
Yeah, it's so heinous as well. It's just so intense. Like, just, yeah, as I say, the entire cast just deserved to be dipped in tar. There's a much quicker sort of title. And how about, I've also read this as well, but do you want to talk about If I Could Reach You, Volume 5? I want to hear what you think about this first before I chip in with my thoughts.
I'm glad you mentioned recently that this was out, because I'd kind of like forgotten to check up on when Volume 5 was. This was a good volume of the series. Like, it's kind of short, but it's probably to its benefit. Like, it's a really focused volume. Like, it really only has two major things that it wants to tackle, both of which are pretty major in terms of like the two of the biggest relationships in the series.
I feel like it kind of needs the space to fully explore them rather than just burn past them.
Yeah, because, exactly. Yeah,
like both of them are extremely important events, and also like they're not the end, but they're certainly a big sort of stamping moment about things.
I felt exactly the same. Like, I was really relieved at the way it handled them, because yeah, it kind of introduces these sort of pretty seismic shifts in the relationships in question, obviously like Uta and Carolee's one being the main one, but then yeah, like, it gives you plenty of time to just kind of like, not luxuriating, because that's not really the right word, but to soak in kind of like what's happened and the shift in dynamic and kind of the consequences of what's happened for both of those relationships, like be they good and bad. And like, it does that really well, I think. Like, I was actually really quite... I was actually really kind of moved by the stuff between Uta and Carrie. Like, that kind of got to me. I think... particularly because it's a really good kind of example, and it felt like it came from a very real place in terms of kind of when relationships are in that kind of point where something has to be said to kind of like break the cycle. But it's like, it's such a kind of, it's a moment that's on such a tightrope. It's such a kind of like raw moment, and it's played out really well, where kind of like Uta like handles the whole thing incredibly well, so it seems, and then there's just one moment, one little comment that's almost a throwaway thing that just completely like turns her in another direction. And like, that I could really relate to that quite strongly, in terms of like, okay, like, you know, I have a handle on this situation, then somebody just says just the wrong thing, or says something in just a way that just like pierces your heart, and suddenly like your entire kind of feeling about the situation just kind of does a bit of a somersault. And like, again, it's one of the things that this series has done really well, I think, overall, is just like capturing those sort of moments in any kind of relationship or any kind of like unrequited love. And it does that really, really well. And then, yeah, like watching that kind of then pan out and sort of seeing how sort of both characters involved are handling or not handling that situation. Like, it's kind of like perfectly pitched throughout that volume. And then, you know, obviously there is still more of that story to be told. And it's also kind of helpful that is offset by kind of some happier stuff going on elsewhere with other characters, where everybody's like, oh God, these these idiots are finally getting a clue and like getting their relationship together. That's cool.
It's nice to have that constructive slow burn continuing at the same time. It provides a really nice backdrop for both the characters and you, the reader, to have something. It's not just a compare and contrast, but it is a fact of like, oh, thank God it isn't just like Uta sad hour again for the entire volume. But I cut you off.
And I was going to say, yeah, like it's even kind of like Uta's own kind of little safe haven in this volume where she's just like, I'm just really happy that you guys are getting your shit sorted out. Like even though like I'm still in kind of a mess, which again, like I was kind of, part of me was wondering whether that would sort of take a turn of be like, you know, kind of like, I hate you for having something that I don't. But she's just like, no, this is great for you guys. Like I'm relieved that you've got things sorted it out. And so yeah, it's just a really nice counterbalance to make a really good volume that kind of, you know, avoided some of the kitchen sink drama that occasionally gets dropped into the series. Like this was the series working with its kind of like strongest set of materials. I feel
like, especially because some of the events that happen in this volume are what like characters were yelling at each other to do in the first volume. And in fact, probably if you go back and listen to our episode about it, this original first volume, that's what I was yelling at least about the manga as well. And it's wild because like it's done in such a comprehensive manner. Like, as you say, like Uta and Kaoru have like a discussion, is all I can really say about it and all I want to say about it. And it's not just about fallout. It's about how people process. And as you say, like, one phrase said at one particular moment is enough to completely and utterly invert or like explode your entire worldview and life. And you know, even if intellectually you can look at what exactly happened in that moment, the what you feel and what the characters feel is so utterly different, and you can't deny that because that is what has impacted them and made them react and, you know, change in how they are going to look at it. And I think the series does an amazing job of letting things breathe. And instead of just having a character stare at the panel and you get a bit of their internal monologue saying, well, I thought about it and then this was my result. And it's just, no, like the characters, all the characters involved in the various relationships and developments are letting them play out. And rather than just being, like, rather than the author turning to you as the reader and saying, this is how it is now, like, it lets things go. And I feel like the amount of restraint there must have been, like, intense, and it works really well. And it's kind of, like, I know I've been the person who's been like, oh, I guess I'll read this later, and oh, I was not loving it, and then I was on the hook again, and I bought another volume, Andy. But in this case, I'm like, no, this series is great. Like, I really enjoy where it's gotten to. I have zero clue what's going to happen from next volume, because as I say, like, a lot of the things that were set up early on have now either been revealed or resolved. Mostly revealed. Nothing's really quite fully resolved. And, like, there's an entirely new set of stakes going on here now, leading into volume 6. Like, you know Uta's mum turning up, which, like, that was an entire fucking whirlwind. And I think volume 4 also had the like chestnut haired girl, like the one that people around the school consider a slut, who like hangs out with them, and that was and her entire deal was fascinating. And I'm glad the series took its time to get to these like events and manage them with the maturity of a series that has a bit more grounding or and like something to fall back on, because I think it really helped like give things the time and also the backing to fully develop their and fully deliver their punch. I'm fully on board with this series, and really fascinated and just massively interested to see what happens next. Although I will say there are still some elements and threads that like are still hanging very much in the air that I think, like, you know, there's an event that happens with Kaoru and her husband, who I've forgotten, which kind of happens in volume 2, which is still hanging very, very unresolved in the air. And, like, what's going to happen there? Like, who knows? So God knows what's going to happen with that. But endlessly interested. So, yeah, really come around on this series.
Yeah. And it's exactly like you say, you know, I didn't really necessarily expect to get to the end of this volume being much like you, of just like, I have no idea what's going to happen now. Like, because I mean, for pretty much every volume up to this point, like, the core conceit, I mean, the core conceit of the series right there in the title has kind of been, like, the thing hanging over it. And now, you know, kind of minor spoiler, like, that's kind of not the case now. So it's like, where do we go from here? And I'm yes, also endlessly fascinated to see what it's going to do next, especially given that it's been pretty proficient in most of the things that it's done thus far. It's like, it's kind of exciting to be just up in the air like that and to have no real kind of cliffhanger in the sense of like, oh, I want to see how X is resolved. It's a far broader kind of like, what's gonna happen with all these characters now? Yeah.
I mean, also very important to mention, a character mentions the title of the series out loud in a speech bubble in this volume, which made me hoot and holler like an idiot because I love it when that happens.
Yeah, which I think was my point. Like, you sent that to me as like, wait, is this the last volume? Like, is that the end? It's like, no, that's not how it ends it, because that's what I was expecting to be like the final line of the series, but no, apparently not.
No, they got another round in the chamber ready to go, I think. So yeah, unless you've got anything else, I really enjoyed this. So I mean, if you were like me and you were like, I guess, like, I'd recommend, like, I mean, I'm not going to say that if you hated it, carry on and buy four more volumes, but I really think this series has its powers on display at this point.
Yeah, so. I think it's one of those series, if you broadly kind of like the first volume, even if you have a few buts and kind of ellipses after that, then carry on with it. Like, yeah, if you hate all of it, it's not going to turn you around. But if you kind of like the core concept, if you like the characters, if you're interested in what their deal is and how they're going to kind of try and sort things out in their lives, then yeah, just like carry on, because for all of its foibles, it kind of knocks it out the park when it really gets its focus right.
Yeah, even with characters and situations that you maybe found a bit irritating to start with, which is wild, in fact most of them. Oops. But yeah, also it has a very important dichotomy of cool mum, bad mum, so you know, it does the entire range of manga mums.
Good mums in this one.
Yeah, also bad mums, but hey,
well, yes, yeah, but bad mums in a good way, so.
I don't know. The problem is I can't really say anything about that without spoiling massive like chunks of it, so I'll keep my gob shut.
I mean, in terms of entertainment value and adding to the series, at least.
In terms of, oh, you just shoved a live wire in this situation, didn't you? Christ. Oh, God, what a thing. I have two other things I want to get to, but I'm going to save them for another episode because we've gone a bit long already, if you don't mind.
Yeah, that is fair.
Okay, moving on to the main part of this episode. Do you mind if I take point on this one, Andy?
No, I'm actually really keen to talk about this, so let's get into it.
Cool. So my pick was Invitation from a Crab, which is a collection of one-shots in a single volume by the author Pan Panya. This is their first work released in the West, as far as I'm aware, translated by Co Ransom and published by Denpa Books. It's a single volume, as mentioned. It's complete. It's just a single thing, like it's a collection from the author. You can get it physically or digitally. It kind of looks non-manga-esque, which I think works to its benefit. I myself got it directly from the Denpa website because they offer ebooks for download right through their own site. So hey, go directly to the source. And so trying to sum it up is difficult because it's a bit of a slippery thing, but Invitation from a Crab, as mentioned, is a set of short stories, and some longer than others. Some go to like 20 pages, like full chapter length. Some parts are just little short essays by the author, which are just about the right size to read on my tablet without getting to squinting mode. And it kind of, the whole thing feels like a series of discussions and sort of meditations on the alienation in modern life and just life. And, you know, one part of this comes through in that the character and the protagonist of all these stories, this very genericized, very low detail anime girl surrounded by a world of otherwise highly detailed, slightly curved, giving into like impressionism and cubism panels of the world around them. Some of the stories get into like downright metaphysical and almost Kafka-esque, to misuse a term perhaps, but a lot of it kind of looks into like the relations of people to the world around them and how they can basically feel alienated or like they've just fallen out of sync with everything around them. In particular, there's one story which is perhaps one of the longer and more interesting ones about a character who wakes up on the train, jumps off of the train because they think they've got to their stop and they're about to miss it, and nope, wrong stop. But then they find that they're not able to interact properly with the world and nothing quite makes sense. There's no bus stop, there's no nothing, and it turns out they're a ghost, but they're not really dead as such. They need to find their body again, and they go on this like weird little adventure with a character called Leonard, who looks like a walking dolphin thing. There are quite a few different like sidekicks that are attached to the main character, and there's also like this creepy like dead demons DD destruction alien head, like a boss who shows up in quite a few, who is wearing like a weird like turn to the side diving helmet, so it looks like their speech is coming out of their ears with no face. And yeah, it kind of goes from there. The whole thing feels to me very much like going on holiday to a foreign land, going into a local art gallery and just finding a retrospective or a modern art installation of mixed media works from someone, like either around a theme or not, and just kind of taking the whole thing in. Like, it does bring to mind, for me at least, like a modern art silent or like black and white film. That's the kind of like very strong feeling I got from it. Like Tate Modern-esque, if I was to use a rather strange like phrasing. And yeah, I kind of enjoyed it a great deal because it let me meditate and sort of like indulge in this very odd sort of like mindset. The little miniature essays in particular are very much like a case of, huh, isn't it weird when you think about this? Anyway, carrying on. And they're like only like half a page, as I say. So, but the whole thing kind of left me in a rather meditative sort of like indulgent mood, sort of musing on life. And then kind of after that, I had to do my laundry. So I came back down to earth of a FUD. But yeah, I enjoyed it a great deal. The art, as I say, the backgrounds are lovely. And the whole thing kind of takes on this slightly disarmed air. Although mentioning Kafkaesque, it does have some nice endings, like happy endings, like, you know, dolphins solving 150-year-old mathematics equations. So, you know, can't be all bad. And yeah, that's kind of where I came down on it. I suppose at this point, what did you think about it, Andy? I don't know. I feel like I had a very particular response to it, as I say, with the whole like modern art exhibit sort of feeling to it. But what did you think?
I really loved this. This was kind of catnip to me. Like, it's
oh good.
it's basically like somebody's kept a dream diary and then turned it into a manga in a way that I can really appreciate.
No, totally. I'm with you. I'm in fact, it reminds me of the game, the old doujin game Dream Diary or Yume Nikki. Just to put that out there.
Yeah, because like every one of these stories just kind of like it has that weird sort of like dropped in out of nowhere kind of beginning, and then it sort of meanders and takes some twists and turns, and you know, it just is kind of like delightful in the way that it does that in every little tale. Like, you know, none of them are particularly kind of like heavy to read, but they just have this wonderful kind of whimsical, you know, just random things that have like cropped up in your subconscious kind of feeling to them, which I feel like kind of the art style also really works with, because there's, especially in terms of like the backgrounds, like they're usually slightly kind of like distorted or kind of like shimmering, or there's this really like they're always like familiar but unsettling in that kind of way that dreams tend to be, where you can kind of, you can recognize a location or, you know, where you are generally, but there's always something that's kind of like off or wrong, or something that maybe kind of clues you in on some deep level of like, oh, this isn't actually like reality, like I'm in a dream here or whatever. And I really like the way it kind of plays with that, especially the way it kind of like mashes that up against sort of the characters that are far more, you know, feel like they've been dropped onto this sort of, you know, this background rather than being all part of the same thing.
Yeah, they feel like carve outs almost. Like even in the first story, the titular Invitation from a Crab, like the character like who is the like very low detail like nondescript anime character, like picks up the said crab, and the crab also loses all the detail because now it has become part of the character's interaction rather than this other thing that is being chased. So that's kind of fascinating how it plays with that in particular.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it also, like, if it was animated, it would have a kind of, like, sort of Eastern European kind of, like, sort of 70s, 80s animation feel, I suspect, where you kind of have that same thing where, like, the backgrounds and the characters don't quite match up. But yeah, so I really enjoyed it for that. But I also enjoyed the fact that, like, some of the shorts in particular, like, actually really have something to say. Like, I mean, my favourite story from the bunch is one that kind of starts out with, like, the main characters, like, oh, I have a job working at a power plant that, like, makes electricity from coconut juice. And it's just like, A, that's a great start to any story, but also, like, it really then runs with that in some interesting ways around kind of the idea of kind of labor and workplaces and, you know, not perhaps understanding, like, what you're actually doing, like, in your job and, like, what it entails and, you know, what is kind of further down the line with that. And it does some really interesting, it's kind of like an interesting little kind of capitalist fable effectively that it turns into from this really kind of, you know, whimsical starting point. It then goes some places and really kind of, like, you know, has stuff to say in a way that it was kind of, like, really, really worked for me. And then there's kind of another one about, like, oh, where, like, how do they grow pineapples? And it's this really great kind of, like, attempted journey through sort of the course of, like, how these canned pineapples, like, get to Japan and, like, where they start from. And the end of the story is basically like, yeah, we still don't really know how pineapples are grown because that's just, like, how the economy kind of works. And the little things like that that I kind of really, I really enjoyed because they're a good balance of, like, fun, whimsical story, but also, like, a little, not a morality tale so much, but just, like, has, it still has something to say about the world that we live in that was kind of, like, you know, I felt was valuable.
Yeah, I think it's important to, as you say, like, it's not just, like, you know, random monkey cheese type dealy. It is very much, like, based in actual observations of lived reality. Like you say, like, you know, the power plant, which gets weirder and weirder. Like, when there's several pages of the characters just walking through the power plant and, you know, the whole thing becomes so disassociated and unmoored from reality that, as I say, it's one of those panels where things just break down into a cubist mess where, you know, you have this, like, painterly, watercolorish look, but nothing really exists in there anymore. And as you say, like, I really love the paneling, which is, like, hand-drawn, like, squiggly line panels. Like, it's not, it's very sort of free form, but also, like, as you say, everything has, like, a bend to it, which really helps draw your eye across the page and move you along, like, the panels, but also makes it so that the character, everything is warping around the characters, to kind of, like, emphasize and, like, just push things around in the frame. But yeah, both the, as you say, both the, like, power plant and the coconuts, the pineapples, story, both, like, as you say, touch on labor relations and also, like, supply chains. And it's quite a few things of that kind where it gets subtly deep without, like, bashing you around the head and saying, oh, I've only got five pages, so I better say something important. Instead, it's more a case of, like, hey, I found something that I can allude to in these stories. And now all the miniature essays are very much along the lines of, I was walking along somewhere and then this thing hit me and I don't have an answer for you, but this is how I felt. Isn't that strange? And it kind of, as I say, it works very much in this, like, meditative, like, put you in a mind space. Like, again, like, I'm sorry to keep barring on about it, but the whole, like, modern art exhibit, sort of reaction of, it's not telling you something, but it's putting you in a mood to be receptive for something and to, like, springboard off into your own thoughts.
Yeah, yeah, and it kind of, like, it's smart in terms of the way it does that, because, yeah, like, this could so easily be in a collection of just, like, really surreal tales that don't really have anything to say, and they just meander and do random stuff because, hey, that would be funny. But, like, it's kind of great reading most of these and then slowly kind of seeing the method to its madness kind of, like, peek its head around the corner. Like, whilst you're still sort of enjoying the weird twists and turns and the weird little moments and the kind of the sheer imagination and ingenuity of it, there's also just this little kind of, you know, there's just this little kind of thing there, that's this little seed that kind of grows of just, like, oh, actually there is something to this. There is, like, something to be said about this story that isn't just, like, hey, look at the stuff that happens.
Yeah, I feel like one of the longer stories that I really kind of, like, given this is a Sunday, it was about a perfect Sunday, and it goes into really crazy places. Like, it starts off innocuously enough with the character being like, oh, if you do your homework early on, you'll have the rest of the weekend to enjoy. And, you know, it's about preparing for the most beautiful Sunday you can possibly have and then doing a trial run of it and getting really caught up. And the whole thing, like, at some point it turns into this like bizarre Wallace and Gromit almost contraption mess of putting machinery all over your flat to make the perfect Sunday and to make things appear at the right time. I think the one benefit of that in particular is it ends on a really positive note, because it'd be very easy just to be like, well, that was a mess, wasn't it? And instead it ends on, hey, congratulations, like we can all learn something and move on, hooray. You can have that Sunday.
Yes. I enjoyed that one. I feel like I saw the ending to that coming, or the twist to that coming, but it also made me feel seen, of just like, yeah, this is how weekends go, this is how this works.
But it's also, yeah, it is how weekends go, and how, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, I still have more time, sweet, like, you know, it's just the ability to compartmentalize yourself in that way. It's really fast, as I say, it's really fun, and like, at no point, I feel like, does this anthology ever, like, leave you in the dust or leave you scratching your head, which is really powerful of it, where instead of it being just, like, out on a limb, it keeps you, like, with it for the entire, even during the more wild flights of fancy. Like, it keeps you on board and, like, you know, in the passenger seat, as it were, which I think is a really, like, astute thing it manages to pull off without you noticing, almost.
Yeah,
well, rather than just like flying off in a weird direction.
Yeah, and at the same time, like it never bores you. Like, one of the things that tends to happen, you know, from other kind of anthologies that we've talked about, is you can always pick out like one or two stories and just be like, that one just kind of flubbed it, that one just missed the mark, or, you know, it just did nothing for me. Like, whereas all of these, I feel like I was engaged with every story on some level, whether it was kind of like looking at the deeper meaning of it, or whether it's just like, huh, this is kind of fun and weird, like I'm into this. And so, like, I never find myself thinking like, oh man, I hope the next story comes along soon, because I'm kind of done with this one. And again, none of these stories kind of outlive or outstay their welcome. Like, they all feel pretty much spot on in terms of like being the length that they need to be, whether that's incredibly short or incredibly or kind of somewhat longer, or whether it is just those little kind of several paragraph little kind of meandering thoughts about like, ah, I wonder if the people in this plane are thinking about me putting out my garbage, or whatever it is, that are just like really enjoyable little kind of palate cleansers at times between the other stories.
Yeah, and I feel like one other thing is that there's enough like shared DNA to, like, you know, keep it kind of cohesive, and also like just keep you along for the ride. Like, you know, as I mentioned, the weird like boss character with the strange head, and like the weird like mole or dog or dolphin people, the dog getting up, standing up outside of its doghouse and just coming in and talking and complaining at you, and the whole thing kind of works. There's a few like names and things as through lines, like Leonard as a name, but it's kind of cool seeing that, just because it's like, oh, okay, there is like, you know, it's not just you know, you just, the character is kind of a nothing. Like the main character is almost like a self-insert, but like just a cipher, but, you know, it's just an innocent person with all this going on, but there's enough shared DNA amongst the stories that makes it feel like a very just comfortable like shared experience set, rather than being like massive gear changes. Like, if you remember Love on the Other Side, the Nagabe short story collection, which we kind of, I don't know, I was a bit disenchanted with, where each story felt like, you know, some of the same ideas and things it was driving at, but there was a massive like grinding gearbox shift between each one, whereas this kind of, you know, keeps things rolling quite pleasantly.
Yeah, I definitely think it helps. And it does also, again, kind of fit into that sort of feeling that all of these are sort of dreamscapes, where there's always enough that's familiar for you to feel at home in whatever kind of world it's dreamt up, but it's also like different enough not to be the same thing over and over again. And I think, yeah, it's a really smart kind of decision to keep those sort of core tenets in terms of like characters and how they look, etc., etc., broadly the same, because it always gives you that familiar thing to tether yourself to, which kind of, it just does a lot of the heavy lifting so that you can concentrate on the interesting stuff and not trying to remember like, oh wait, so which one was the main character of this story, or was it this guy, or was it the other one? And it's like, you know, you don't have any of those concerns, because you've got that kind of mental map immediately from the very first, kind of the first couple of stories stories of just like, okay, I kind of know how this works, how this sort of broad cast comes together, even if they're maybe not playing exactly the same roles.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah, as I say, after like the first like 10 pages, you're like, okay, good. Like, I'm on board with and know what this is playing in. I don't really have too much more to say at this point, apart from, as I say, I greatly enjoyed it. And, you know, I know I've said this already like three times, and I've apologized for it already, but it really did put me in this like kind of satisfying position of having looked at a cohesive body of work, even in a single manga volume. Not to bang on about it, but with lockdown and that, it did make me pine for going to a strange art museum and just seeing what's going on and watching like a 20-minute silent video of a man smoking in a turbine or something. which I don't know, maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just a thing that Elliot likes to do on his holidays, but it did put me in that mindset of, oh, I just watched this like American photographer's body of work, and I probably don't remember his name, but I enjoyed watching this stuff, and I've come away with things to think about. So, you know, it kind of works on that level, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely has that kind of like visit to an art gallery feel of like, yeah, like I've seen something a bit different. I've been given some homework, if you like, to go away and think about, and that's like that feels like good value for money, right? Even on its own, and the fact that it's kind of entertained me in the process, like, so much the better.
Yeah, plus it makes me think that, is there a model kit out there that will make pickled radish for me? Which I love that, because as someone who puts together model kits, and it's like, I don't understand these directions. Oh, okay, it worked. Weird. Yeah. So yeah, came out really enjoying this, and I know I say this a lot on this podcast, but I've had this in my library for at least a year and a half, and it got to the point of being slightly scared of looking at it because, you know, people I respect talk highly of it, and I was like, oh no, is it going to live up to my stupid inflated thoughts? And it turns out yes. So hooray. But yeah, you can buy it directly from the publisher, or you can get it online from most good digital bookstores. You can still buy it physically. And as I mentioned, I really love the cover treatment because it doesn't look like every other manga volume. It puts me in mind of one of the old Penguin classics with the silver coloration and the stock photo, so that kind of is catnip to me. Like, I love that kind of cover art design.
It is kind of fitting. Yeah, I mean, I ended up picking it up on Kobo. I don't think I saw it elsewhere, but yeah, like it was pretty cheap on there, to be honest, as well. So yeah, like, it's not, if this was kind of like, you know, 15 quid or something, then, you know, maybe there's a bigger barrier to entry, but like it kind of feels like you're getting a bit of a bargain for what is in there.
Yeah, totally, I agree. So yeah, really enjoyed it. So moving on to your pick, Andy. If you want to take it away.
Yeah, indeed. So my pick for this episode is Volume 1 of Blend S, which has just come out recently from Seoul Press. There are 6 volumes in Japan currently, so a bit of catching up for them to do. And this was a series that I kind of picked for two reasons, as I mentioned on the last episode. Like, one, this is one of those series that I'm kind of curious about, mostly because... partly, I think, because of the anime opening and kind of some of the outfits becoming like popular for cosplay. It's one of those weird series that you see quite a lot of it. Back when we had conventions, like you'd often see Micah, the main character's cosplay, turning up a surprising amount. Like, I think it's just one of those kind of outfits. And so it's had this weird sort of long tail, even though it's never been like a massive hit or anything. And also, secondly, it kind of fits into that kind of comedy set in a workplace vibe that I've kind of enjoyed with stuff like Working, aka Wagneria, and Servant Service. So I was like, let's give this one a go, because it feels like it's part of that sort of holy trinity, if you like.
Maybe new game as well.
I mean, new game,
because they publish in the same magazine.
Like, it's also in that kind of similar wheelhouse. So Blend S, the main character of the series is Micah Sakuron. Oh god, I've not written this very well.
Sakuronomiya.
Yes, yeah. My handwriting went horribly wrong there on my notes.
When I wrote it down, I thought it was three names, and I was like, wait, that doesn't make any sense.
when we start out with her, she's desperately looking for a job, and she's just been rejected yet again. She wants to save to study abroad, but she has that age-old manga character problem of having scary eyes, and nobody will kind of employ her because they all think that, you know, she's either some kind of delinquent or, you know, she's mad at them, etc., etc. And as a result, while she's kind of like consoling herself after being rejected and kind of basically staring into the mirrored surface of a cafe window, looking like, does my face really look that bad? She basically ends up being dragged into said cafe because apparently, like, she's perfect for a job there. And the reason for that is that it's basically a roleplay cafe where all of the various waitresses kind of have their shtick, they have their gimmick. Basically they want Micah to work there and to play a sadistic waitress, which she's not really into the idea of, but she desperately needs a job. As it turns out, she's really good at just being accidentally sadistic, by trying to be nice whilst also looking kind of upset / angry / mean, etc., etc. And so from there on, kind of the cast gets expanded out. Like, there's another character, Matthew, who's kind of like, he's kind of the opposite, if you like. Like, she's pretty kind of short with people, like, generally, but she plays a kind of cute little sister waitress. There's Kaho, who kind of goes down the Sendera angle. And then there's Dino, who's the manager, who's kind of a bit horny for it all, to be honest. But
he's horny for Micah in particular.
Micah in particular is his jam in a way that somehow this series kind of manages to sidestep that feeling too awful most of the time, and I'm not quite sure how.
I'm with you on that. I don't know how it does it. It seems to have enough innocence, and like, Dino in particular is like stupid enough that you don't worry about it. Like, he's not like, I don't know, like, there's nothing too grab handsy about him. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we need a female voice on the podcast to correct us, but I don't know, he never felt too egregious.
Yeah. Well, like, I think there's that. There's kind of the side of it, yeah, where he's kind of like, yeah, he's too kind of stupid or whatever to kind of do anything beyond kind of getting a nosebleed and kind of like leering a little bit at worst. But also, I think kind of Micah's character is built up to the point where, like, you know, if he oversteps the mark, like, she will, like, knock him down. And I think there's always that feeling of, like, she's always kind of in control of those situations, and there's never any point where it kind of feels like she's particularly uncomfortable beyond, like, what's up with you? Like, you know, there's never any kind of real kind of feeling that ever becomes problematic in that sense. And I think it kind of, like, manages to dodge a few bullets that way. This volume overall, it's pretty fun. Like, I kind of enjoyed it. I think the problem that it has is it sort of feels like it runs out of steam quite quickly. I mean, Maybe this is the kind of series that can, as it moves onwards and upwards, it can maybe find more things to do with its cast. But, like, it feels like it has its sort of solid idea that works for, like, half a volume, and then there's not really a lot more you can do with kind of the characters and their kind of their bits and their behavior. And it sort of, it feels like it's sort of, it's running out of road relatively rapidly. I think the only thing that manages to kind of keep it going for me is I just kind of find myself quite liking all of the cast. They're all kind of like a likable bunch at the end of the day. And it was sort of, even when maybe like the humor had sort of like run its course, it was still just kind of nice to hang out with them for a bit, which is maybe not enough to push me onto like reading more volumes, but it at least kind of powered me through this one to the point where I was like, yeah, that was decent enough. I was cool with that.
Yeah, I must admit, the one thing about this series that got me the most was when it first starts, the like first or like prologue chapter, which I'm guessing was probably made for the collected volume to help ease you in, was like, you know, it's very sort of shoujo-esque, almost like sparkles, like fated meeting between the characters as an intro. And then it's a 4-panel manga, and I had no idea it was. And I was like, oh, shit. I thought, oh, is this an omake? Is this 4-panel manga like a post-chapter, like, gag strip, it's like, oh no, this is the series. This series is a gag manga, a four-panel manga, but the intro was this, like, very believable prose-like, like, you know, just series of characters missing each other, you know, just introducing the main character with her plight, and then, boop, nope, it's a four-panel manga. And it's like, oh, okay, shit. Like, I don't know why that caught me off guard so much, but if anything, I was kind of a relief, because I was like, man, I don't want this, like, weird, overly done, slightly tortured thing, and then, boop, nope, four panels, gags, here you go. So, yeah, that kind of caught me unawares.
Yeah, I think that's a smart way of playing it as well, because I forget what series it was we were talking about previously. It might even have been New Game, where, like, there are times when it feels like a four-panel format isn't right for it, and it kind of struggles to fit into that, whereas I think this is actually quite smart that it doesn't go for that from the get-go. It gives itself time to set things up and breathe, and then once everything's set up, then it's far easier to just drop into that four-panel format. And yeah, I think I kind
see
of
how
appreciated
it, you can see
that.
How that kind of got added, though, because, like, the very first four-panel strip basically sets up, like, Micah is main character, Micah looks scary, here we go, and that's kind of it. Like, that's the first four-panel strip. So
yeah, indeed. But yeah, like, I think it probably plays that quite smartly compared to other series that kind of shoehorn that in from the get-go.
Totally. I mean, the one thing I'll say is that sometimes the panels do seem a little small. I mean, obviously you've got eight panels to a page because it's two four-panel strips on each page, but it does feel at times that, like, it's kind of straining to keep all the characters and all the things that are going on inside frame. So it can feel a bit claustrophobic at times, but I think it does a good job of, like, you know, the whole, I know I talk about this a lot with series, but it does a good job in, like, adjusting the level of character detail. In particular, I think Micah's, like, chibi-fied self works really well, because it kind of draws her in this cutified version that is basically how other people see her, with slightly more scary expression. She just looks a lot sharper, as it were. So that kind of works really well with her when she's, you know, she's like pulling, like, a shit-eating grin almost half the time. And that works from, I don't know, that kind of works for the gag, in particular if the gag is just, like, her not getting something.
Yeah.
Which also another part of it is that, like, she's basically, like, raised in this, like, very traditional Japanese family sort of environment, which she's, I don't know, I presume there's some kind of chapter about that coming at some point. But, like, she's, like, trying to get away from that and, like, go see the world outside.
Yeah. I mean, strangely, I feel like that was kind of, that was the one gag that didn't get old for me in this volume, was her, like, whole accidental sadism thing. Because somehow, like, it always manages to make that play in a way that is actually pretty, pretty amusing. And, like, even when you know it's coming for, like, the umpteenth time, it always manages to find a spin on it that somehow kind of got at least a smile out of me. So as much as other parts of it ran out of road, it felt like that's like, you know, maybe it's just because it doesn't overuse it and it kind of, like, meets it out in a smart enough way, but, like, there was never a point where it's like, I wish they'd just knock this joke off.
Yeah, I must admit, the one part of it that kind of fell flat for me, which unfortunately kind of so the part that didn't work for me, and it feels like it rose from beneath, like this swamp underneath the series to consume the cafe whole, is that it just, with Micah is the exception, it turns every character into an otaku. Like, it, at the start, that is not obvious. Like, you know, you have the characters working in this cafe, and you assume they have their own reasons for doing so, and they have their particular little habits, but then it just makes each character a type or a subset of otaku. Like, the owner ends up being this late night anime fan, you know, fine, okay, you can have one of those. But then the chef says, oh yeah, I'm a big manga fan, and it's like, okay, that's weird, you didn't need to make him an otaku too. And then it turns out the tsundere one is a massive gamer who is also very good at claw games, and there's an Aikatsu reference. And then, you know, the college girl who plays the little sister character turns out to be a cosplay nerd. And it's just like, oh, this suddenly has circumscribed and made these characters extremely boring, where all of them are now just nerds. And, you know, whatever, fine, enjoy what you like. But it makes all the characters feel extremely boring all of a sudden, and just takes any kind of, like, I know it sounds mean, but it takes a lot of mystique or depth out of them, where it's just like, oh, you just made all the characters nerds because that's all you really want to write, or know how to write, I suppose, of having a bunch of nerds. And it makes it very easy to then base jokes around that. you know, like, for example, like the Tsundere one, like ripping a DS out of someone's hands to put in Monster Hunter details, which works and it's a good gag, but it's now become a fact where it's like, oh, all these characters now feel extremely dull because they're all just nerds. That's the part that kind of really irked me, where it's just like, oh, you know, you just flattened this entirely.
yeah, like it's either that it's all the author knows how to write, or it's just like pandering to the audience. And yeah, either way is not particularly a good look. And yeah, it is annoying, because like I said, sort of on a surface level, I kind of liked all of the characters, and they all kind of have, you know, decent enough personalities that you kind of, you know, you're willing to kind of hang out with them effectively and kind of watch them bounce off of each other. But yeah, like, it does feel like that strips away a whole layer of kind of potential interest in terms of, and again, perhaps this is why it runs out of road so quickly, because it strips away so many potential avenues of kind of interesting stuff you can do when they're all kind of railroaded down that single kind of like otaku track. That doesn't really particularly, you know, benefit the series at all.
Yeah, because you end up with Micah having the only one who has a real sort of goal in mind for any of this. And, you know, it's not like you have to have a goal in mind to do a job. I mean, hell, you need money to survive. But it's more the fact that every other character then becomes, oh, I want to buy anime figures. Oh, I want to buy manga bonuses. I want to buy cosplay outfits. I want to buy video games. And it's like, oh, well, that made all the cast very boring suddenly. Like, you just, like, they have a contest to try and make, like, a new dish of the day or whatever, which I think is a really good chapter and is really fun and has a good load of jokes and then has a really funny payoff at the end, where it's like, oh, this was successful, but not in the way we thought. And that works really well, and it's kind of, and like, that's a really good gag. That and one of the perils of a four panel manga is it blows the entire really funny gag in one four panel strip, and it's like, oh, okay, that's done. Whoops. Like, you could have hung an entire chapter on that gag. But you know, if anything, it's probably like a sign that it just used it up. That's kind of my main problem with it, and also why, along with you, like, the characters are nice and I had fun hanging out with them, but the whole thing kind of felt a bit flat and ran out of road real quick towards the end.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, it's one of those, like, I wouldn't necessarily be against kind of reading future volumes if they're on sale, etc., but it's certainly not going to be a kind of burning, like, oh, this was hilarious, like, I'm definitely going to read more of it, or kind of like a massive kind of, you know, desire to see what any of the characters are going to do next or anything like that. It is what it is, and it's fine at that, but it doesn't really kind of, you know, it doesn't really grow out beyond that. And again, you know, you kind of compare it to something like New Game, where you've actually got there's always kind of like a bigger picture thing going on, rumbling in the background, that kind of helps push the characters and whatever scenario is going on forward. And even like something like Hidemari Sketch, like, because you've got that constant kind of cycle of a school year and everything going on around it, like, there's always a goal somewhere. Like, it's kind of exactly like what you were saying, you know, whether it's exams or whether it's just like, you know, there's another holiday coming, or like, oh, Christmas or whatever. It always has something that it's kind of the characters are aiming towards or moving towards, whereas this sort of feels like it's almost in a sense of stasis, where everything is just kind of happening because it's in the four panel manga rather than because of the passage of time. And that somehow kind of like strips something away from it, I think.
Yeah, it feels just kind of unmoored, and the whole thing, like, it, you know, it kind of strips away like several layers of like what could be interesting background. As you say, like, New Game, they're making a video damn game. You know, as you say, Hidemari Sketch, they've got their schooling to do, etc. You know, other series will do that sort of thing where it's like, oh no, there is something going on here. I mean, hell, even like Miss Kobayashi's Dragon Maid has the travails of being a programmer at work sort of thing. So, you know, there's something there, whereas this kind of is this like almost like TARDIS out of time, like, gag comedy thing, which, you know, is inoffensive and has some good jokes, but didn't really get its claws in me as such.
Yeah, and I think to get away with that, you have to have kind of stronger comedy chops than this series kind of manages to muster in the end. Like, because I mean, you know, sort of something like Working/Wagneria, like, from, you know, the anime version of that, it has the same kind of problem, where it mostly doesn't have kind of anything to work towards, but its characters and its comedy are so strong that it doesn't matter, and it kind of, you know, it conjures up scenarios because its characters are interesting as well. Like, it can conjure up scenarios to fillet each episode, whereas this kind of, it doesn't have enough to hang its hat on to actually make that work once you get kind of, you know, so far in and you've introduced everybody and their bit.
Yeah, I mean, all I can really say at this point is that you mentioned it at the start, but I have a volume of Servant Service somewhere on my tablet, so I should probably read that at some point.
I've not read any of the manga adaptation of that, I think, or the original manga, rather. Like, I've only seen the anime adaptation of that.
There's quite a few volumes out now. It's been going for a while. It's one of these things where it's like, oh, damn, like, you're on volume X? Christ. So... yeah, but yeah, I came out away from this kind of like being like, yeah, fine, you know, whatever. But yeah, not exactly chomping at the bit, and I have enough other stuff to read, quite honestly, that I'll probably... This is going quite far back on the list of things that I would carry on with.
Yeah, yeah, like, I think if you're like a slavish fan of like four-panel manga, then like, you know, this is maybe kind of, you know, something that you'll enjoy and want to dig into, but otherwise it's kind of one of those, like, there are better versions of this on the market, a couple of which we've already kind of mentioned there, so.
Man, I want to read a thesis paper about four-panel manga now, or just a convention panel. Like, that sounds like a... I don't know, I want to hear someone have their high-level take on and, like, analysis of four-panel manga.
There you go. If anybody's listening and wants to do a virtual convention panel on that, then, you know, 2021 is ripe and ready for you.
Hey, man, I'll commission you. Fuck it. I'm bored enough that I'll commission someone to write something that I want to read. Not kidding. But yeah, one last thing. I bought this directly from Soul Press. Their website has like a front end and a site, and it flat out just gave me an EPUB file, which I have like a certain number of downloads on, and I've backed it up. But yeah, that was nice. That was very seamless. It just did it through PayPal. It worked out the same price as every other store out there. And yeah, the EPUB was well formatted, better than some bigger companies that do Humble Bundles, in fact. So that was actually quite pleasantly surprising, and like, oh, cool, that worked well, good. So
because that's usually the thing that keeps me away from EPUBs, is like, you know, having had bad experiences with Humble Bundle ones, of just like, I'll just buy it on Bookwalker because that's the safe choice.
Yeah, or Kobo also works really well. But yeah, so, and also the Soul Press website does have links to other sites where you can buy it from. Mostly American, but some will internationalize and direct you to the localized format as well. So, but yeah, I mean, because not to throw them under the bus, but I mentioned I was going to read this, and I had like friends making jabs at some of Soul Press's problems with physical distribution. So, hell, everything's a bit wild right now, so I don't really blame them. I got it digitally, and that was good, so hooray.
Yeah, distributing physical products can be hard, as it turns out.
Yeah, especially when they get stuck in Dover. or in the case of Soul Press, I think they're the ones whose like publishers just their like printers just completely died on the vine like several times, which sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, that is the kind of thing that can happen.
Andy Hanley says with a kind of weary like story behind it sound of voice. Anyway, so yeah, Blend S, volume 1. So yeah, there's that. And I should anything else, Andy?
No, I think that's me on that one.
Cool. So moving on to what we're talking about next time. So I picked something that I have probably mentioned in passing a few times and have read before, but as there is an anime coming out now, I figured let's talk about it again. So, or let's talk about it properly. So I have picked volume 1 of Heaven's Design Team. And Andy, how about you?
Yeah, I'm excited for your pick. So yeah, I've been enjoying said anime adaptation, and this is another one that's been on my list of like, oh yeah, I need to read that at some point for God knows how long. So again, finally, I can get around to it. So yeah, on my part, I kind of like found myself thinking like, I've not really been on the Weekly Shonen Jump app in a while, and like,
well, I mean, Chainsaw Man ended, so why bother?
Yeah, so you know, I should check out the Lie of the Land and see what's going on, and decided that it would be remiss of us not to to read Hard Boiled Cop and Dolphin, just because I wanted to say those words on a podcast.
Well, done. So we'll do that. Yeah, we'll grab. It's on the Shonen Jump app, as mentioned. It's on the vault. So read through the first volume-ish percentage of it. It's one of the wonders of the Shonen Jump app is you can basically, or the Manga Plus app or any of those particular apps, is that you can just end up diving into something, which works quite well. Cool. So, thank you very much for listening. Moving into close down, you can find our website at screentone.club. You can find our Patreon, as mentioned at the top of the show, at patreon.com/screentoneclub. Any support is greatly, greatly appreciated, and as mentioned, help to defer the cost of the manga. You can find us on Twitter at Screentone Club, or one word. You can also email us, if you so wish, at show@screentone.club. When this episode comes out, in fact, back on the Patreon, Ben, we will have one day left until we close voting for our bonus episode choice. And the voting is wide open. So if you jump in at the $3 tier, you can directly influence the vote. Hooray. My name, as mentioned, is Elliot Page. You can find me at Elliot Page on Twitter. Mostly, once again, posting pictures of my cat, who is finding very comfortable places to curl up and sleep, which, honestly, extremely jealous of. I know I mention this every time, but whenever I leave my home office, I walk past the open doorway to my bedroom and I get to see her completely zonked out on my bed. And it's like, damn, so jealous. And Andy, how about you?
I have no such concerns when I leave my office, because I have no cats zonked out anywhere. But you can find me on Twitter nonetheless at Hannah's1979.
Cool. So thank you very much for listening, and, well, good night.
Bye, everyone.